Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Let James Holland take you to places in history you've never been before. The Savage Storm is the fascinating new book which brings to life the story of our Allied forces as they crossed into southern Italy in 1943. With unflinching and insightful detail, Holland places you in the heart of the action of this pivotal and brutal World War II battle. The Savage Storm is out now and available from all good bookshops. Attentie, attentie, which is, of course, Dutch for Achtung, Achtung. Though I'm not going to attempt a Dutch accent, having nearly caused a diplomatic incident on Thursday in the live stream. For the regular listener who's not a patron, that probably sounds like double Dutch, what I just said then. On Thursday night, we do a live stream, a live cast, where you can see James and I in the flesh live discuss matters of historical import, as well as engage in basic slapstick of the highest quality. Quite a lot of slapstick. And we had a Dutch question for a Dutch listener. So I did a hilarious Dutch accent, and then mayonnaise, it turned out he was actually watching. Yeah. Exactly, I did the full mayonnaise. Hey, do you want chips and mayonnaise with that? And sexy girls. And he was watching, which was embarrassing. Anyway, hello. Welcome to We Have... Well, so did I. And at your collapsing portrait gag that you opened with, and using a brick from the Berghof to hold it up, it's the most James Holland thing I've seen in my life. Don't worry, I have a brick from the Berghof to hold it in place. Incredible.
It worked very well, though, didn't it? It was no more falling of the wren.
Right. But anyway, and by the way, if you go to the Patreon, you can watch this live stream. It's up there for all to see. Anyway, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. A big hello to Simon, who stopped me in the park yesterday in West London and said, I love listening to this. I've listened to all of them. It's my morning commute. That Jonathan Ware, he was lively, wasn't he?
Yeah. Do you know what? I listened to a little back to a little bit of that. And God, he was... It was like he just couldn't get it out quick enough, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah, yeah. We'll probably have to have him back on so he can squeeze the rest of it out. Anyway, many of you, I mean, what I love is that
the passion, man.
You know that he's a younger member of the Afflicted, isn't he? I mean, he must be. What is he? In his late 20s or early 30s? I don't know. And he really, 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 really wants this sorted out and discussed properly.
Cares.
Yeah, he really cares. Anyway, many of you will have seen the explosion of a wartime bomb in Exeter this weekend. What a thing that is!
Whoa. I mean, you're just thinking, okay. I mean, I know that was quite a big bomb that they were detonating, but that was a hell of an explosion. That's just one. I mean, you can see why Exeter got a bit hammered in the war, can't you? You know, a couple of nights of quite a lot of bombs going off, and you know, old ancient medieval city, cathedral city, and it's going up as toast, isn't it? Which is, of course, exactly what happened.
And that's a controlled, you know, it's a muffled explosion that they've got there, where they've covered it in dirt and.
Yeah, but hell of a lot of stuff going up in the air, wasn't it? Crikey.
And that thermal image was really interesting as well, that the heat of it too, not just the blast. But yeah, I mean, yes, as you say, I mean, if that's coming out of a Heinkel, they're dropping what, a dozen of those each or six of those each?
Yeah, they can't go very much, can they? What was that? Was that a 500 pounder?
I think so.
Yeah, so they can make them. So what's that? 500 pounds? That's like yeah, they can take about a ton, I think, a Heinkel. So they can probably do four of them,
yeah. Well, there we are. Listener Glanville Bentley, watching that, was reminded of the famous Richmond Golf Club temporary rules of 1940, which he sent to us, and here they are. These are fantastic. Richmond Golf Club temporary rules 1940. Well, should we read them alternately? James, I'll do the odd ones, you do the even ones. Rule one, players are asked to collect bomb and shrapnel splinters to save these causing damage to the mowing machines.
Keep calm and carry on. Number two, In competitions, during gunfire or while bombs are falling, players may take cover without penalty for ceasing play.
And that rule must be because some bounder said, well, I didn't duck and cover in a bunker. That hole, I won that hole, thank you very much. Exactly. Someone else has gone, well, I don't think that's awfully sporting, old chap. One could have been killed. Number three, the positions of known delayed action bombs are marked by red flags at a reasonably, but not guaranteed, safe distance therefrom. I mean,
it's just too good.
Okay, I'm getting the health and safety executive on the phone for this one.
Oh, dear. Number four, shrapnel and or bomb splinters on the fairways or in bunkers within the club's length of a ball may be removed without penalty. And no penalty shall be incurred if a ball is thereby caused to move accidentally.
Well, that's my
very stuff. That seems fine, doesn't it?
That's exceedingly... Yeah. Five, a ball moved by enemy action may be replaced. Or, if lost or destroyed, a ball may be dropped not nearer the hole without penalty. Well, that's good. So you're on the seventh hole or whatever, and a Heinkel goes over, a Dornier goes over and drops a stick of bombs, and if your ball is moved by the blast wave...
You can put it back. Assuming there's not a six-foot crater.
Well, yeah, exactly.
We'll cross that bridge as and when. So number six, a ball lying in a crater may be lifted and dropped not nearer the hole, preserving the line to the hole without penalty. Can't say fairer than that. They've thought of everything, haven't they?
Seven, a player whose stroke is affected by the simultaneous explosion of a bomb may play another ball from the same place. Penalty, one stroke. Hermann Göring ruined my handicap.
Yeah, exactly. I would have been scratch if it wasn't for Göring. That's amazing, isn't it? Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, clearly someone said we need to write some rules written in great... Those strike me as written in great humour as much as anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely tremendous. And Goebbels' response, I think, rather underlines the lack of humour.
Yeah, he had Lord Haw Haw use these rules to ridicule the British. This is what Lord Haw Haw said in a broadcast after the rules became the equivalent of a 1941 trend on Twitter. By means of these ridiculous reforms, the English snobs try to impress the people with a kind of pretended heroism. They can do so without danger because, as everyone knows, the German Air Force devotes itself only to the destruction of military targets and objectives of importance to the war effort. I mean, honestly.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's why
they burned Rotterdam to the ground. As barefaced lies go, I mean...
That's quite up there, isn't it?
It's certainly up there. That's very good. A huge thank you for Glanville Bentley for jogging our memory on that. And Glanville
he sounds great. He sounds like he should
he
be.
He sounds like the secretary of the golf club. Yeah, he's the guy. I say, Glanville, would you write up some new rules, please, old boy?
Yeah, hard cheese, old chap. It reminds me of that wonderful Pont cartoon of the blokes in the pub sort of sitting by the bar and leaning on it and looking completely unperturbed by absolutely everything as though kind of time has stood still. And the caption says, meanwhile in Britain, panic grips the nation or something like that. Yeah, it's absolutely superb.
The other thing is this Chips Channon stuff that Guy Walters drew my attention to, friend of the show Guy Walters drew my attention to on Twitter this morning. Chips Channon was an American socialite, wasn't he? Sort of a feckless bloke with lots of money who became a Tory MP. I mean, is there a connection? And was a big appeaser, big fan of Chamberlain, sort of was always trying to be in with the in crowd. So when appeasement was cool, was in, he was part of that movement. And then when it wasn't, he wasn't. And his diaries have been released unredacted and are extremely racy. Because he was a colossal shagger and seemed to get everyone to talk to him about that as well. So here's an example. He had a boyfriend, because he was a bisexual. He had a boyfriend called George Gage, who was a courtier, who dined at the French embassy, dining in state with the king and queen. This is one of today's extracts. So George V and Queen Mary. George was between Mrs. Winston Churchill and the Lady Mayoress. Mrs. Churchill confided to someone the other day that she never knew when she was safe from Winston. He exerts his conjugal rights at odd times and in unexpected places, frequently after a debate. You know, I think that's a little... I mean, surely... I mean, people call Winston Churchill an imperialist and a racist all the time, but I've not read about him being like a sort of randy devil.
No. You don't really associate it, do you, that kind of side of things with Winston?
No.
Because he looks sort of round and sort of, you know, just slightly asexual.
Well, and people in top hats don't have libidos, do they?
No. Certainly not with wing collars.
Anyway,
I've read the original Chips, Chan and Diaries, and I've got to say they're pretty entertaining, so I've high hopes for these.
Well, but it's vast chunks that were redacted, because it's all his affairs, and it's all the gossip and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's interesting the sort of because there's him, isn't there? If you want like a sort of behind the curtain view of what's going on. And he was a big friend of Edward VIII, wasn't he? He was a big mate of his.
He was an out and out socialite. I mean, he just knew everyone. His address book was one of those really, really fantastic ones that he just knew.
Yeah. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because after the war, because between the wars, you've got all those sort of people with open marriages. I mean, the Mountbattens were at it too, weren't they? And then after the war, that all sort of closes down, doesn't it? And you don't talk about it anymore.
It's funny, isn't it? Well, you know, it's very strange, isn't it? Because, you know, in the very first part of the century, you know, it's absolutely, you know, you just didn't get caught at all. You know, that wasn't the way you did things. And, you know, young girls' lives could be completely ruined if they'd kind of so much as had a kind of a kiss before marriage. That all sort of changes post-First World War, doesn't it?
Well, it's like people have thought, well, what's the point in worrying about that? There's a more, you know, those moral shifts are quite interesting, aren't they? But yeah.
A lot of sort of bed hopping going on in the Second World War, inevitably, again, for precisely the same reasons. That, you know, whatever the people are thinking post-First World War, they're now thinking, well, you know, I might get blown up tomorrow by a Heinkel, you know, might as well.
But it's Chips Channon and Duff Cooper and people like that who, if you want to have a look, certainly what's going on behind the scenes in sort of Tory England, they're the diaries to go and look at.
And there's Hugh Dalton as well. I don't know whether he was a serial shagger or not, but there's a lot of diaries from those people at the top, because of course inevitably they knew they were kind of going through great moments in history, so they keep them. So if you want to get a sort of, you know, a very clear view of what it was like at high politics in that period, in the late 1930s and throughout the Second World War, pretty easy to find it.
We hope you enjoyed our Sunday edition of Family Stories, as well as an extraordinary private letter written by Douglas Bader from his hospital bed.
Oh, that was something else, wasn't it? Whoa.
And also, the PS, this is, you know, I crashed a plane doing something stupid that I shouldn't have done, basically. It, my fault, my bad. I thought it was the most extraordinary letter.
Yeah. But it's okay, because one of my legs was only amputated below the knee, so it'll be fine. Oh, that's all right then.
Yeah, I know. I mean, he's 21, so you might be able to think like that when you're 21. I think if I lost both my legs now, aged 52, I'd think, well, that's me screwed forever. You know, that how he managed to pick himself up and carry on is pretty interesting, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely determined to fly again, isn't he? You know, you're saying his love of flying hasn't diminished at all, and he just wants to get back in if he possibly can.
He is one of those people who, had the war not come along, you do wonder actually what he'd been able to do with himself. You know, he was lucky, in a way, perverse way, lucky that the war came and had a good war. So, I mean, it's...
But also, he was very kind of sort of... I mean, he was a man of incredible focus, wasn't he? So he's very tunnel vision. It's like, I am going to walk again very quickly. I am going to get back in a plane. You know, when we... You know, I am going to organise big wings. You know, I am going to fly recklessly over Northwest Europe. You know, I am going to do this. You know, he's very kind of sort of... You know, and that's why I've always called him a kind of sort of my way or the highway type. You know, you're either with him or you're not, you know, and be part of my gang. And he's got that incredible force of nature, hasn't he, that is incredibly seductive, that always attracts people, repel people, yeah, and that's where he gets into kind of, you know, into sticky water, but hot water rather.
There was also a story of a young man known as Rice, because he loved his mum's rice pudding so much.
Oh, that was heartbreaking, wasn't it?
That was not easy to read. What did you have? Because I listened to it. Yeah, it's the one bit of the podcast I actually do spend time to listening
yeah,
to
no,
every week.
Yeah, I did. I went on a bike ride yesterday and listened to it when I was cycling around the sunlit lanes of Wiltshire. I loved the Chindit poem. I thought it was lovely.
Yeah, it was good,
sort of
wasn't
moving.
It?
Yeah, it was really good.
strangely moving.
There was a couple of lines where you think, God, how's he going to get that word to rhyme? And it's, oh, yeah.
And you had the ducks, didn't you? You had the guy with the ducks,
yeah,
the top
guy with
secret
the ducks,
duck.
Which is good. Yeah, no, that was fascinating. Writing the red, you know, the red crosses on that.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
not fooling the Hun.
Yeah. No, not fooling the Hun for one moment.
And the boy,
the evacuee, yeah, that was very good.
I've got to say, I really like these family stories, though. I just love hearing them, and you know, some of them are necessarily kind of quite ordinary, but no less interesting for that. But some of the stuff that's coming out, you know, whether it be Chindit poems or rice pudding or letters from Douglas Barlow, is just absolutely extraordinary.
Well, I'll be. Here's the thing. It's the bit of the podcast I can get the non-afflicted to listen to because they actually go, gosh, isn't that interesting? So I cannot persuade my daughters really to sit down and listen. I mean,
I thought Scarlett was getting quite into it, or she kind of got bored.
She has got into it on and off. She gets into the sort of ones about a sort of cultural sides of stuff rather than she's not going to listen to us talk to Jonathan Ware about the Churchill. That ain't going to happen. Right. But she but some of it. And she's nevertheless fascinated by the Nazi side of things rather than British war effort. I think it's the thing that she's, because after all, she did GCSE Nazis, you know, like, and A-level like everyone does. So she's sort of interested in that. But the family stories, because it's so sort of, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it is family stories as well. Some of it is people's diary entries, but also some of it's, this is what I know, I think I know my grandfather did. And so it's got that sort of lucid quality of it being handed down, and you know, and a big thing we have discovered is that actually people don't know, or they think they know what happened in their family, and then you go and find out and it's something else altogether, which I think's also really, really interesting.
Yeah, the manila envelope that's found at the bottom of the drawer. I mean, I also,
exactly,
all of them are tinged with a kind of sort of with a sort of cloak of wistfulness, though, aren't they? You sense the regret that people didn't speak to these people earlier when they had the chance, and there is this, you know, all of it is suffused with
melancholy. Yeah.
Yes, because they're all gone, and if they're not gone, they're kind of not far from going, and it is depressing. You know, it is sad that generation, particularly, you know, you and I grew up with, they're absolutely just a part of life, are suddenly soon to be no more.
Well, this Thursday, we've got a special edition of the podcast all about the birth of the Spitfire with guest Paul Beaver, whose book I am tearing through, Spitfire People book.
It's good fun, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, really good fun. A great way of doing it, of approaching the subject, because, you know, everyone's stories, the stories sort of hand on to each other like batons. So when you get to the test pilots, you go from Mutt Summers via a couple of other guys at the RAF back to Quill, and you know, and that's really, really interesting. And you know, the first guy to crash a Spitfire, to bed, you know, like the sort of that kind of minute detail, I think is really interesting. The first person to belly land a single wing a high speed fighter, you know, all those kind of milestones in its development, really, really interesting. And then
I've got to say, I'm a big fan of the Beef. He's one of life's can do people. You know, you rarely ring him up and ask him something and he says no. I mean, he always goes, yeah, that shouldn't be a problem, Jim. And off he goes, you know. It's just.
But he obviously really digs the Mark One as well. So, you know, he's.
I love the Mark One.
Oh, yeah. Well, and Friday, of course, marks the 85th anniversary of The Fighter, the Type 300's first flight, because it wasn't called the Spitfire, K5054. Yes. Yeah, that's right, exactly. Then we're live streaming, of course, on Thursday night. Join us live at 8:30 UK time for Slapstick Adventures. Lots of fun last week, thanks to the Wren behind you. She's not there now. Now, we're going to try and answer some of your questions, but we've gone full on primary source for you today. Because what did you find, Jim, that you sent to me?
Yeah, well, I mean, so this I got from Carlisle Barracks, which is the US Army Heritage and Center, or I can't remember what it's called. But anyway, that's where they have, the US Army has its basically big archive. And all the Gavin papers are there. So when was I last there? Maybe kind of 18 months ago, something like that. Actually, I was there with PCA, with Peter Caddick Adams. And so I went through all, and I just photographed it all. And I've just been sort of looking through it because I've been writing about Market Garden very excitingly in my Sherwood Rangers book. And the Sherwood Rangers were working with the 82nd All-American. So I thought, oh, well, I'll just go back to all that Gavin stuff that I've got. Because I just, you know, I was looking at it for Sicily, but I thought, well, while I'm here, I might as well just, you know, get everything I can. So I hadn't really looked at this before. And it's his you know, it's his account of his take on Market Garden, what he thought about it and why the decisions were made and what he thinks, you know, should be taken note of for the future and all the rest of it. And it's just, it's really, really interesting because this is written contemporaneously, pretty much. Does it have a date on it? July 1945.
No, 4th November 1944.
Yeah, so pretty fresh.
And it's sent to, well, it includes extracts from, it's sent to Hap Arnold, isn't it? That's who it's for, isn't it? Well, it's for the Commanding General Staff School, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. But Hap Arnold's been sent a copy. It's got bits of stuff from Breton and Arnold in it. It's a very interesting document. I mean, because after all, he says, you know, this was a fantastically run show, all in, doesn't he?
Yeah. Actually, we can post this up on Patreon. We can post this up because there's no copyright with American stuff.
It's very interesting because I mean, my main takeaway from it is he says we were all the time we were at full stretch. So you everything 82nd Airborne were doing. We really didn't have, we were doing at our absolute limit. And he says, if we had a battalion less, we wouldn't be able to achieve this. And if the enemy had a battalion more, we wouldn't be able to achieve it. He says that's in here somewhere, which I think
that is a big area. I mean, you look at it, he has got a lot to do.
No. He's got an awful lot to do. And in this, he's saying, as a matter of fact, the narrative account does not tell the whole story. So he's looking in, he's saying, hang on a minute, you know, there's been a version of events go around that isn't quite right. So there's a bit, I mean, it's really, really, really interesting. First of all, the first thing he says, though, is he says the planning for these things is faulty. If any outline plan is accepted by us and approved by Supreme Headquarters, we're invariably placed under the authority of one or the other of army groups for detailed planning at their level. This is faulty. Many of ground force commanders have indicated a desire for purely local and tactical employment of the airborne forces. In this respect, their vision and education could be compared to that of the average senior ground commander concerning his conception of air support 4 years ago. So he's saying if the 21st Army Group plan a thing. They have absolutely no an airborne thing. They don't know what they're doing. They have absolutely no idea how to deploy us, how to use us. And he says, so far as the 21st Army Group is concerned, I've been compelled to arbitrarily refuse to consider many of the projects submitted. And that's fair.
I think he's probably got a point on that, hasn't he?
No, that's completely fair because stuff gets drawn up. I mean, after all, you know, the endless cancellations that have gone off. Stuff gets drawn up. Stuff gets ditched. Airborne forces, however, by this point of the war, are acting outside their original conceptual role, which is flanking on seaborne landings. That's what they're for. That's what they've been designed for, set up for. So no wonder there's some disconnect going on, because everyone's in a new situation. So I think he's right, but there is an explanation for that.
And also, let's not forget that we're talking, you know, a little over a year since the first major airborne operation.
Yeah.
And only kind of 3 months since the last, the proper airborne operation, which is where most of those guys have actually dropped. I mean, you know, it's only two of the parachute infantry regiments dropped on Sicily out of the 82nd, none from the 101st. So, you know, it is still really, 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 really new. And what was, you know, the takeaway from Sicily is just absolutely that the army commanders are just going, OK, we've got this stuff and we might as well use it. You tell me how to use it and let's crack on. Brilliant. You know, we've absolutely no concept of how it works.
Yeah.
And that hasn't really, you know, that's not going to massively change in a year, is it?
Well,
when operations are so infrequent.
And it's certainly not going to change in 3 months. you know, from D-Day, is it? That everyone, after all, I mean, what have 82nd Airborne, 101st Airborne been doing? They've gone away and they've had to refit, replace, rebuild, haven't they? That's what that's clearly their priority. I mean, there will have been some post-match reports, which after all lead to how the drop zones work out for 1st Airborne. But
I mean, I love this line where he goes, communications must be positive and well established between the bases from which operations are launched. It was like, duh, yeah, of course. But that sort of underlying one of the major problems of Market Garden, and all of it goes back to kind of, there's just not enough time. There's not enough time to plan for this. This is only 7 days in conception.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break because there's so much in this.
Yeah, let's not spoil it. We don't want to do this.
Let's not spoil it. We'll be back. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. And James and I are engaged in primary source history, like proper historians today.
Yeah. Well, it is wonderful looking. I mean, this is one of the exciting things about studying the past and studying the war, is when you get your hands on documents like this. I mean, it really, really is, because you can read someone else's opinion about Market Garden, and goodness sake, there's quite a lot of those opinions sort of swishing around. But this is Gavin, you know, this is the commanding general of one of the airborne divisions, and played an absolutely critical part in that battle and its outcome. So it's fascinating to have this.
Yeah. Well, so he says, I would like to present a few of the conditions which must be fulfilled to increase the chances of success of a large-scale airborne operation. The first has been mentioned above. Don't send a boy to do a man's job. Concentrate the maximum force on the principal objective. This sounds, well, exactly. This sounds trite, but the ground force planners persist in presenting a multitude of objectives. An all-out effort with everything that can fly must take advantage of the initial surprise by dropping the maximum of supplies and reinforcements before the enemy can muster his air, flak and ground defences. All troop drops and landings from the outset must be in combat teams, no matter how small the combat team is. By this I mean that you cannot count on landing your parachutists today, hoping to land their heavy weapons and transport in a landing lift today or tomorrow. Boom, right there. And that's the thing that goes straight into Varsity, is that everything you can do in one lift is done in one lift.
Yeah, well, he's absolutely right about that, though, isn't he?
He's completely right about that. So that's that. I mean, that I find that really, really interesting, because he's obviously saying we were at full stretch for this whole operation, and you can't divide your effort, because at the top of the thing he says, what does he say? He says the absolute watchword is application of the principle of war, economy of force and mass. Which, of course, then leads us to, so what's going on?
The great speak heights? Well, yes, absolutely. And the concentration of maximum force on the principal objective. So I think what he's saying is that, unfortunately, we weren't able to do that because we had too many objectives. And we had to decide what was the principal objective. And the principal objective, unquestionably, is capturing the Nijmegen Bridge intact.
Yeah.
But he's arguing that taking the heights is a vital precursor to that.
And so then we go to July 1945. So the second half of this document is a letter from the Office of the Theatre Historian, 17th July 1945, to Chief of Staff, 82nd Airborne. Dear Sir, and so this is from Captain John G. Westover, saying, a complete history of Operation Market is now prepared in the theatre historical section. Blah, blah, blah. However, I've some initial needs. And question one is, I need a definition of the initial objectives of the 82nd Airborne Division. Was the capture of Nijmegen and the Highway Bridge considered part of the initial objective? Question two, what person, staff or headquarters made the decision to apportion the weight of the 82nd Airborne Division to the high ground rather than the bridge at Nijmegen? Why was more emphasis initially placed on the bridge across the Maas and the Maas-Waal Canal rather than the bridge at Nijmegen? Who made the decision to send the 1st Battalion 508th into Nijmegen on the evening of the 17th? Was the Colonel of G 508th Regiment ordered to move on the bridge or merely to set up roadblocks outside the town? And then I need a copy of the orders, blah, 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 blah. I mean, so, and then, and
so
then
he's, Gavin... So clearly Westover's trying to put this report together and thinking, hang on a minute, why on earth didn't they just go all out to the bridge?
Yeah. Which is interesting. And so, thank you for your letter.
Yeah, so, dear
Captain Westover, your letter of July 17th to my Chief of Staff regarding Operation Mark has come to my attention. So, in other words, someone's gone, boss, this, you're going to have to answer this. I can't answer this. First, let me say that I'm very glad to find the Theatre Historian's Office taking a close interest in this operation. Those of us who participated in the operation consider it a model airborne show.
Yeah, now, isn't that amazing?
You see,
isn't he means that the landing, though, doesn't he? And he means the way they fought and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. Though I have had the good fortune to be present at the planning of most of our operations in the ETO and participated in four of them. 82nd Airborne Division's participation in Market was well conceived and very well planned, considering the short time available, 6 days. The mechanics of its execution were almost perfect. The entire operation was conducted on an extremely marginal scale. So here we come to the bit I mentioned earlier. I do not believe that one battalion less could have done the job. And if the Germans had committed one good battalion more at any point of our perimeter, we would have been in serious difficulty. See, that's very interesting.
Mm.
We therefore appreciate your interest in the operation. So... for the objective of the 82nd Airborne Division, I advise you to check the operations order of the British Airborne Corps. I quote the 82nd's mission. 82nd Airborne Division will seize and hold the bridges at Nijmegen and Grava with sufficient bridgeheads to pass formations of the Second Army through. The capture and retention of the high ground between Nijmegen and Groesbeek is imperative in order to accomplish the division's task.
Hmm.
Right now, one of those things comes before the other, literally, doesn't it?
Yeah. But catching the bridge definitely comes before the heights.
Well, that in the order.
In the order.
In the written order. However, it's imperative to hold the high ground to accomplish the division's task, he says. Or the order says.
Well, I would interpret that as get the bridge, then secure the heights, because you've got to hang on to the bridge once you've secured it. And holding the heights will enable you to do that. But first of all, you've got to get the bridges. So they seem to manage to do this absolutely no problem at Grave. They get that bridge, and they hold it, and that's great. But they don't at Nijmegen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so what he
says...
I mean,
you know, he's that experienced. How can you interpret that any other way?
I'll tell you why, because the Nijmegen-Groesbeek high ground was the only high ground in all of the Netherlands.
Well, that is true.
With it in German hands, physical possession of the bridges would be absolutely worthless, since it completely dominated the bridges and all the terrain around it. I still think holding a bridge isn't worthless if you're holding it. The understanding was therefore...
I mean, it's interesting, the Groesbeek Heights. I mean, you know, day-to-day, there's more buildings on them. Groesbeek itself is a larger town than it was back in 1944. But actually, the shape of all the woodland is pretty much the same. I've been looking at aerial photographs from 1944 this week, and it's one and the same place. Beek, Mook, these places, they're all pretty much the same. Ziflik, another little village, just sort of, and Weiler and all these places, they all look the same. It's very, very wooded on the top. And what is really interesting in the subsequent fighting that takes place around Groesbeek is that they do capture the heights, but most of the fighting is off the heights. So the heights are in the middle, bordered by the Waal to the north and the Maas to the south. And between the rivers and the heights is a nice little bit of polder land. And that's where all the fighting takes place. It's not on the heights.
Yes. Well, yeah. Because the polder land is where the bridges are. That's the bit that's how you control the causeway, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. But that's where the Germans are attacking. They're not trying to. The Germans are not trying to go straight up onto the heights. They're attacking around the sides.
Well, and also because the at one point there's a wayward intelligence report that says, oh, there's like 1,000 Panzers in the you know, over the German border. You think, well, if there's 1,000 Panzers, you're not going to do this operation full stop. You know.
Yes, and the troops that are coming. The troops that are coming from the Reichswald. So you've got this. You've got Nijmegen. Then to the southeast, you've got an east. You've got the Grosbeek Heights. You've got this little corridor of Polderland due east of Nijmegen, which leads to the German border around Beek and Weiler and all the and Ziflik. Barely does the forest of the Grosbeek Heights stop, then the Reichswald begins. And you're in Germany, and that's the kind of great wooded barrier that leads to Kleve and all the rest of it. The other side of that, you've got the Wehrkreis 4, which is a regional recruitment and training centre from which a corps is hastily established, built around one hastily put together infantry division. And these guys are shocking. You know, they are not well trained. So although you've got a handful of guns, anti-tank guns, a handful of SPs, you are not talking Fallschirmjäger here. You are not talking fanatical Waffen SS. You are talking, you know, really scraping the barrel stuff. Now, so from an offensive force, you would have thought the attacking force coming up towards the Grosbeek Heights and on this Polderland to the north and south of it are probably not going to be your highest grade troops. And that should have come into the reckoning when they're
I personally consider that the key to the accomplishment of the entire mission and thought that even if we were driven off the low ground around the bridge, if the high ground could be held, ultimately the Second Army could accomplish its mission. I mean, that, you know, he says it was obvious that we had to get the bridges across the Maas-Waal Canal. And he says that particularly, he says that based on my experience in the past, particularly the bridges over the Medereck River in Normandy, where I lost a major part of the 507th Parachute Infantry because of my lack of foresight in seizing bridges that would enable us to maintain some tactical integrity within the division. So he's saying tactical integrity is the thing that's really important. He's saying he'd be dividing his effort if he goes to the Nijmegen Bridge, and that command of the high ground is the key thing. I think it's really, really interesting, this idea that you need a tidy battle. You need to fight, tactical integrity and all that. I think that's really interesting because they don't have it on D-Day. One of the things that especially the Americans really suffer from on D-Day, isn't it? Is that the drops are confusing and confused. They don't have this tactical integrity. That obviously is the thing that really matters to him. So part of this must be a reaction to his experience of D-Day.
Well, sure, and before, I would say, because, you know, what is the 505th objective on Sicily is the Pian del Lupo, which is this high ground just to the kind of northeast of Gela. You know, again, it's high ground that they've got to land on that high ground, take it, hold it. From there, they control the roads below, and they can control they can deal with counterattacks. You know, when they get to, you know, the 82nd on D-Day, you know, there is that stretch of high ground which is focused around St. Mary Glees, which then drops down to the Murderay, then drops down towards Utah Beach. You know, it is, again, it's about holding that high ground. You know, when they are able to kind of see off the German counterattack over the Murderay at La Fiere, etc., that's because they've got the high ground. You know, it's not very high ground, but it's still higher than the surrounding countryside. So I just think that, I think high ground is just so part of his kind of
thinking
that he can't sort of really get beyond that. You know, high ground, well, I've got to get the high ground.
And this idea that you need tactical integrity because that way you've then got tactical flexibility and you can react to situations far more, especially as you have no, you know, and this is an airborne thing, there is no rear ever. And this is what first airborne get hung up on, you know, the idea that it's an untidy battle and And, you know, Urquhart gets very hung up on that. Hackett turns up saying this is an untidy battle. It's interesting that they... This is the thing they're concerned with, is this idea of tactical integrity. When in fact, what actually you're doing is causing a chaotic situation to destabilize the enemy.
Well, just think what would have happened
by doing an airborne landing.
I mean, what just imagine they'd use one of their battalions to go and take Grave and the other two to go hell for leather, helmet, to go and get the Nijmegen Bridge, secure it. You'd have done that in, you know, within an hour or two of landing. I mean, you know, by the evening of the 17th, it would be in their hands. I mean, it would have been all over. So that gives them plenty of time to then go up to the Grosbeek Heights.
Yeah.
All the time in the world. You know, they absolutely could have done both. I mean, I completely get the whole point about the importance of the Grosbeek Heights. But it's about the order in which you do it. You go hell for leather to get the bridge, secure the bridge, then you secure the heights.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking about big distance here. I mean, you could walk to the Grosbeek Heights in, you know, hour and a half.
Yeah. Yeah.
From the bridge. I mean, it's not a big distance. It's a matter of a few miles.
What I will say, though, is dominating ground is the thing that does for 1st Airborne Division. Or terrain is the thing that, you know, where 1st Airborne are pushing into the town and they're on that, by the St. Elizabeth Hospital and the museum, where the staffs are destroyed, there is that extreme slope, and the Germans are on the other side of the river in that brickworks and are able to pin them down. That if you don't hold the dominating ground in that situation, you are in real trouble. So this does happen in this battle elsewhere, that the Germans use the terrain tactically extremely effectively, and 4th Parachute Brigade's attempt to go uphill into the woods around Wolfhazer is met with similar disaster. But that's as much to do with the fact that that's on the third day of the battle. They've squandered their surprise. And they're up against heavier armed troops that they have no response to, because that's your problem if you're an airborne formation, is that you're essentially light infantry. So, I mean, this is very interesting, though. But he does say, your next question, what person, staff or headquarters made the decision to appoint the portion of the way to the 82nd Airborne Division to the high ground rather than the bridge at Nijmegen? This decision was made by myself and approved by my corps commander. So it was his, you know, he's absolutely saying the buck stops here, but I checked it with my boss. So I don't know that you can put that on Browning, really. You can. That's him saying, my assessment, sir, is this, and Browning going, carry on, Jim, isn't it? I think, right, it doesn't read as the other way round, where he's going, where Browning's going, I insist you do this. This is what you need to do. This is Gavin's assessment that we have here.
Well, we talked about this the other day, you know, the Browning insisting that he took the high ground first. I mean, that's one of those quotes that's been quoted in every single book that's ever been written about Arnhem, for which there is no source, apart from just someone said he said it.
Yeah. Whereas here you have, this decision was made by myself and approved by my corps commander. So you could see that as Browning's dereliction of duty, that Browning wasn't smart enough to see that he was wrong. But then Browning hasn't led men in battle, certainly hasn't led an airborne division in battle. So Gavin coming to him going, well, this is what I'm going to do, Chief. You know, he doesn't say.
But it's also not that he doesn't send, you know, he sends Lindquist's 508th to go and get the bridge. But Lindquist only sends one company forward. And that then gets put down into one platoon, who then get lost and can't find it. And it's just not pushed forward with enough determination. So actually, you know, a whole battalion should have been enough to get the bridge, to be honest. But I mean, two would have been better, obviously. But it's not that Gavin doesn't send them to the bridge. I mean, you know, and it's interesting about Lindquist, because Lindquist is... There's a lot of people that feels he shouldn't have been a commanding officer. He was much better as an XO, you know, the second in command, where, you know, the sort of pen pusher, or the guy who was the admin guy, you know, the person who could sort of organise everything, but didn't have that kind of sort of cut and thrust of a kind of real gung-ho fighting man. And it is, you know, he is arguably, in terms of kind of fighting power, he's the weak link in the 82nd. And yet he's given the most important job, which again, that's got to be laid at Gavin's feet, because he's the divisional commander and it's up to him who goes where.
But it's too late. This is the thing, is that you know, you squander your tactical surprise. However, all of this ends with him saying, I will be very pleased to receive any illustrations you prepare of the Nijmegen sector. As I said, to most of us who participated in a number of airborne operations, this has been a model of planning and execution, and we are appreciative of any interest shown in it by the theatre historian's office or higher headquarters. So he's saying, I didn't do anything wrong. Here are my decisions. Yeah,
I hold my head up high.
They stack up. Yeah,
it is interesting. So the other thing is this whole thing about that. You know, they were. You know, then the guards turn up on the 19th, and they've regained some of the lost schedule. They turn up and they can't. You know, and they're going to sort of do a joint attack across, but they haven't got enough boats to do it. You know, the boats haven't come up, but presumably that's sort of because no one's expecting them to have to go across in boats, are they?
No, there's no.
So why would the boats be there? I mean, if you're talking about sort of priority of kind of, you know, moving 30 corps forward and material that you need and ammunition and food and supplies and guns and anti-tank guns and all the rest of it, I guess boats are quite low down on the list, aren't they? Because the whole point of it is that you've captured the bridge.
You captured the bridge. I mean, they take boats to the Pegasus Bridge. They take boats for that. That there are boats in those for the sappers. I mean, partly in case the bridges have been blown, but also so they can check for explosives on the bridges. There are boats taken for that, but not that you could shift a battalion or a regiment. Not enough to do a major.
Right. But then it gets pushed back another 24 hours. So it's not until the 20th that they're then getting across. And of course, by the 20th, it's too late, isn't it?
But he's adamant. I mean, he. Physical possession of the bridges themselves is nothing if the terrain dominating these bridges is completely held by the enemy. In fact, he could have destroyed the bridges by shellfire or at least denied their use constantly if we permitted him to hold the high ground. This concept becomes elemental and very clear on the ground, although I suppose from this distance and from the map, it needs some explaining.
There's a bit more than just some explaining.
Well, but yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm a fan of Gavin. You know that. You know, I think he was really rated, and I think this is, you know, one of very few mistakes that he makes. Actually, you know, he's completely fearless. He's a brilliant commander. He's much loved by his men. You know, he doesn't rant and rave. He's quite an intellectual, even though his background, of course, is a humble one, and he's a deep thinker on modern combat and how things work and. What can you know? How you can improve the airborne arm and all the rest of it? He's just got it wrong on this, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I can't see there's any alternative. And I think all this is down to the speed of which it's put together. And I think it's part of his absolute Pavlovian response to any situation in which he finds himself, which is to get the high ground.
Yeah. If the high ground were not held, it would have been captured before the British could succeed in establishing contact in force with the Nijmegen bridge forces. So he's saying, if the bridge at Nijmegen were seized and held and the opposition were tough enough, it would have been a division operation in itself, such as developed at Arnhem. So he's saying if we'd held the bridge, but not the high ground, 30 Corps wouldn't have been able to rescue us at the bridge because they'd have had to clear the high ground and we'd have ended up stuck like 1st Airborne at Arnhem.
That is basically what he's saying. But I think what we're saying is he could have done both as well. Get the bridge, then get the heights. You know, there's no way that hastily cobbled together core of really, really bad low grade German troops is gonna take the Grosbeak Heights in 24 hours.
Well, or winkle him off the bridge. If he's in the bridge and in the town, because after all, the Germans in the town take some winkling out when Guards Armour turn up, because they fight very determinedly. I mean, in a sort of mirror action of what Frost's men do at the bridge in Arnhem, you know, being blasted out of houses one by one by armour in the end.
I've got to find out is exactly what they knew about the enemy before they dropped. I don't have that at my fingertips, so I don't know.
Well, who knew as well? You know, how far the ultras actually trickled down.
Yeah. Anyway, did Gavin know about the enemy that he was up against? I suppose that's what I'd be really interested to know. Yeah.
Well, you know what? We had some questions to answer and we failed miserably. Well, this coming Friday, of course, thanks for listening, everyone. This coming Friday marks the 85th anniversary. If you could hear us scratching our heads doing that, that's a good thing. This coming Friday marks the 85th anniversary of the first flight of the Spitfire. And Thursday's podcast will celebrate that fact with our guest, Paul Beaver, who's fantastically entertaining and wore pilot shades for the whole of the Zoom conversation, which made him the most infinitely cool guest we've had on. Thursday night is our regular live stream night. We'll see you all at 8:30 UK, 8:30 PM UK time for that. Thanks very much, everyone. Cheerio. Bye for now.
Cheerio.
Hello, listeners. It's Anita Arnand here from the Goalhanger sister podcast, Empire, which I host along with...
me, William Dalrymple. And we are here to tell you about our new series on the Founding Fathers, the men who made America.
We wanted to look at the men who actually founded the country, who dreamt the dream, who wrote the words upon which a country would be born. What were they like? What made them do what they did? What did they actually believe in? And how did they come to play the role that they did in the American Revolution and the creation of America?
What really interested me about this was the contradictions. I mean, we expect these men to be great figures. We've seen the portraits in the galleries. We know the faces from the banknotes. But they're deeply complex figures. But in that, and in that blend of contradiction and intellectual power and writing genius and curiosity and raw ability, lies the nuance and complexity that allows us to understand them. And the United States is in many ways a reflection of them, their beliefs, their experiences.
These are the men who wrote the Constitution. These are the men who created the federal system. In every way, they are totally fundamental to what American politics looks like today.
It all goes back to this extraordinary group of men.
Yeah, and they have rip-roaring yarns as well, let me tell you. So if you want to know why America is the way it is and who the men were who made it, you can listen by searching Empire wherever you get your podcasts.